listen to the voices of our world.
I think probably the one thing you realize when you're over there is how fragile and precious your life is.
There's a wave of veterans coming home to America, and the VA is not ready for it.
There was a guy, he received a shrapnel wound from an IED in Iraq and spent a few months in Walter Reed. They wouldn't let him go until he paid his hospital bill.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. War makes wonderful people do horrible things. Some wars are judged as just, or at least necessary. Others remain as haunting questions that gnaw at us and at history. But the soldier does not judge the war. Our soldiers have always gone forth to answer a call, fulfill a duty, obey and do the job, more often than not, with honor. Therefore, it is completely possible to support our troops, even when we do not support a particular war, or the leaders who foisted that war upon us. Today, we honor our troops, talking with former U.S. Army Field Artillery Officer, now Senior Advisor for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America's Political Action Committee, Jeremy Broussard, and then with the Executive Director and Founder of the IAVA, Paul Rykoff. Jeff Lacey came back from Iraq and hung himself in his parents' basement with a garden hose. The night before he died, he spent 45 minutes on his father's lap, rocking like a baby. That story is contained in a poem, Eli Came Back from Iraq, by Andrea Gibson. Whether that story is true or not, the number of American soldiers who served in Iraq or Afghanistan and are believed to have ended their own lives are a very real part of the overall casualty numbers to date, 2,376. Of the 505,366 troops returning from Afghanistan and Iraq as of February this year, 144,424, or 29%, have sought Veterans Administration health care, and 20,638 of those, 14%, have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Democratic Senator from Connecticut Chris Dodd proposed increasing veterans' health care spending and paying for it by rolling back some of President Bush's capital gains tax cuts, but the full Senate voted to hold on to aid for the wealthy. There has been a 107% increase in deaths related to IEDs, improvised explosive devices. But surviving soldiers often end up on a whole new bureaucratic battlefield. Some wounded soldiers had to pay back their enlistment bonuses because their wounds kept them from serving out their full enlistment contract. Then, too, stories are mounting that soldiers whose lives were saved by issued body armor are being forced to pay for equipment that may have a bullet hole or bloodstains. That all by itself may seem unthinkable, but how do the families of the fallen, in both theaters, how do they handle the steady drip of news that tells us we were lied into war? 2 days after Pentagon experts informed the administration that the flatbed trucks found in the Iraqi desert were used to fill weather balloons and were not rolling chemical weapons labs, our commander-in-chief publicly stuck with the original story. In January 2003, when President Bush told us he was still working with the United Nations to avoid war, he had already told Prime Minister Tony Blair that military action would follow anyway and chose March 10th as a possible start date. After serving as an Army field officer in Iraq since the war began in 2003, New Orleans native Jeremy Broussard most recently served his hometown organizing private relief efforts. Now a law student and a dad, Kathy Golden talks with Jeremy Broussard, senior advisor for the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America's Political Action Committee.
You come from originally New Orleans.
I do.
So between your service in Iraq and New Orleans, you've seen every kind of disaster. So there's nothing you haven't seen, Jeremy.
You know, I tell you, in Iraq, going through these towns in southern Iraq, I saw all this death and destruction. And I would see just buildings just totally obliterated and people living out in the street and just the way of life for everyone there, just destroyed. And I never would have imagined something like that could have happened in this country, let alone my own hometown. So, it's been a rough few years, but it's surreal sometimes, you know, living through history like this. The Iraq that I saw in 2003 is a lot different from the Iraq that is existing today, both in terms of the current status and in terms of our mission. When I was there, our rationale was that we were stopping Iraq from using its weapons of mass destruction either against its neighbors or to give to terrorists. And there was a sincere belief among everyone out there that they were going to use at least chemical weapons on us. I remember there was this point during a war, during the events, where there was this called a red zone around Baghdad, and there was a fear that once we crossed that red line that they would use chemical weapons on us. And let me tell you, we carried our protective gear really close to us because we were seriously concerned about that. Coming back, the more and more you learn about what they were deceiving you about and what wasn't true and what wasn't there, the more angry you get, the more you want to do something to change the way things are. The problem is that the mission and the role of troops in Iraq is nothing like it was 3 years ago, and that now we're trying to prop up a government without really addressing a lot of the ethnic and sectarian problems, so there's no real consideration for ethnic and religious differences. And all of those are now bubbling to the surface. And as much as there's happy talk about how we've created a democracy and isn't that wonderful, there hasn't really seemed to be a plan in place in terms of what the U.S.'s role will be either toward the sectarian violence or toward a stable and democratic Iraq. But we really have no long-term plans for the country. Meanwhile, we're spending billions of dollars building huge bases in the deserts of Iraq, as well as the largest embassy of any country anywhere in the world, $1 billion in going for the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. And two, we haven't given clear goals to the troops who are out there putting on the line every day. You know, when I was in office, I was an artillery captain. I'd tell my guys, today you're going to go to this place, you know, execute this mission. You'd go out to a firing point at this grid coordinate. You're going to fire these 5 rounds at this target in order to allow our troops to get around that target without being shot at. Who, what, when, where, and why? The problem now is that there is none of that type of specifics in terms of our planning. You know, the president has not even gone so much and said the U.S. troops in Iraq will train the Iraqi military so they can defend themselves by a certain date. Otherwise, we're going to tell the Iraqis that, you know, this has gone on far enough in order to establish a more stable and self-sufficient Iraq. What we keep hearing is that, you know, as Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down. However, the Iraqis continue to fail in their ability to protect themselves and defend their country themselves. So what we do, we just make excuses and give passes to them to allow us to stay at the almost 140,000 troops with no end in sight. And with 2,300 soldiers plus killed and over 20,000 wounded, the American people are getting fed up with it because it seems so open-ended. It seems that they were great in terms of getting to Baghdad over 3 years ago. Their whole plan seemed to be to get to Baghdad in April of 2003. And once that was accomplished, they literally had no idea what to do next.
It looks to so many of us that this was something that they had a gleam in their eye about for 15 years behind closed doors, you know?
Right.
How does that make troops feel?
I know when people are out there day to day, a lot of the policy and the debates about what we're fighting for and why kind of get pushed to the wayside. You know, my whole goal was to get my soldiers there and back unharmed, and I was able to accomplish that. But when you do get back, you have to start asking those tough questions, and sometimes you don't like the answers. And that's something the American people have to do, is ask those tough questions, you know, the questions like Helen Thomas asked, questions that may not seem very polite, but questions that, you know, are on everyone's mind, and address the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room is, why are we really there? There's no weapons of mass destruction. There were no ties to Al-Qaeda before we got there. There had to be something you really wanted to do. And as you mentioned, the fact remains is that a lot of those neocons who were in the Defense Department in the White House, who wrote letters to President Clinton as far back as 1997, 1998, advocating the overthrow, who were part of the first Bush administration in the early 90s, who wanted to continue on to Baghdad, including then Secretary of Defense Cheney. These people had an agenda. Coupled with the Downing Street memo, which said that the intelligence around the decision to go to war was being fixed around a policy, you know, you give me the facts to support my war, and I'll give you the war. The cherry-picking of intelligence is something that was claimed and continues to seem to be the case in terms not only just in terms of intelligence on a war, but in terms of facts on the ground. I get sick and tired of hearing people talk about how, why isn't the good news about a war being reported? It's a war. That's the nature of war. War is about killing and destruction. And either you're doing more killing and destruction in the enemy, or they're doing more against you. Mm. And our chief complaint seems to be that you spend so much time talking about the fact that they're killing and destroying Iraqis and Americans that why don't you cover the school we built? And the argument of that is that who cares about school being built if no one in the town feels safe enough to send their kids down the street to go to the school? And that's the reality in the country right now. And that's some of the problems. And the American people see that. I mean, I think for a long time, we as a country have really wanted to believe the administration. I think it was just so difficult to admit that we'd all kind of gotten suckered into this over 3 years ago. But, you know, the fact is, it's 3 years, 2,300 dead Americans, 50 to 100,000 Iraqis dead. We're there. We're stuck. The administration is adrift in terms of where we go from here.
And you guys come home having been exposed to depleted uranium, and that stuff sits in the ground over there, killing people for another 50 years. And you look at over $200 billion, that could have saved maybe. We lost a whole American city. We lost New Orleans.
I'll tell you. And not only that, there are some estimates now that say when it's all said and done, even when all the troops come home one day, when you couple the health care costs from depleted uranium, which is a carcinogenic, they've already elevated levels of leukemia among children in Iraq. But once all those health care costs from the veterans, the cost of replacing all the equipment that was damaged and destroyed in Iraq, all the money spent deploying to Iraq, when it's all added up, it can go up to $2 trillion. That's trillion with a T. So not only could we have rebuilt New Orleans, but we could have solved the whole Social Security solvency issue that was supposed to be Bush's primary agenda last year without having to privatize it. So there is a tremendous cost. You know, we have massive deficits. They just elevated the debt ceiling to $9 trillion,
yeah,
with a T. I mean, that's, I think, $30,000. I have a 15-month-old daughter. She owes $30,000. I owe $30,000. My wife owes $30,000, all because people want to spend money they don't have. It's tremendously draining on the American economy, and this is something that long after Bush is out of office that we'll be dealing with probably for the rest of my life.
Yes, you're right. I have one last thing to ask you, Jeremy. When I was a little girl, my dad wouldn't tell us anything about the war. He would never speak of it. I did hear some things about what he went through my mother. She would tell us. What do you expect you'd be telling your daughter when you think she's old enough to hear what you want to say?
I guess what I would tell her is, you know, Dad went out to help make her safe even before she was even thought of, and he did the best he could. And sometimes things didn't happen the way they were supposed to happen, and good people got hurt, and sometimes bad people got away with doing bad things. But people go out and they have to do sometimes what we would consider horrible things to make sure that we're all safe. And it's something that's not to be glorified or cheered. It's something that's really somber. And, you know, I really pray every day that with people suffering and dying for Iraq right now, in part, will help prevent a future war that my daughter will never have to serve in. I'm sure she'll, just like I did, my dad's a Vietnam vet, you know, I'm sure she'll flirt with the idea of maybe a military service one day. I think it's great and honorable. I just hope she can be in a peacetime military and not a wartime.
Thank you very, very much. It was wonderful.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Has our Department of Defense fully supported our troops? Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us. You can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.